is Lear. I'm a librarian here at Teenscape. Thank you all so much for joining us. Housekeeping, cell phones in silence, please. Restrooms are straight out the exit downstairs or the art department. Also, we have a photo disclaimer. It's usually right there. You maybe get photographs taken, but mainly of the back of your head because we like to get photos of the speakers. So. Thank you all for joining us. Help me welcome all our guests today on the topic of journalism. We have Miss Jane Dobia. She is a senior librarian at one of our LA public library branches, but prior she was a freelance reporter for NPR and The Independent. We have Ashley Alvarado, Director of Community Engagement for Southern California Public Radio, and Chris Keller, Deputy Director of the LA Times Data Visualization. So you are getting recorded for a podcast, so we'll share the mics, and then I'll repeat the questions from the audience as we go through. So the first general question is, welcome, and what path have you taken to get to where you are today? And we are always curious about any internship opportunities or specialized training you've done.
Okay, so as you can see, I'm the oldest person here from my gray hair. And so I was in journalism a while ago when things perhaps were different than they are today. But from conversations that I've had with my nephew, who is also interested in being a journalist, I realize that there are some things that are similar. So I really began seriously working in journalism in the late 70s, early 80s. My path then was, first of all, through a love of writing. And then I was able to connect with a local newspaper in Detroit where I started doing book reviews that gradually grew into freelance reporting on the news. And then something called Solidarity happened in Poland. I had been doing research on the labor movement in Detroit. And a labor movement in Poland called Solidarity managed to seize control of, well, not seize control of the government, but to prompt significant changes in the way Poland was run. It was at that time part of the Soviet Union. And then in 1981, they were outlawed. Martial law was declared, and all the journalists were leaving, and I decided to go. I didn't know Polish. I did have Polish background. I knew I loved the labor movement, and it seemed to me that this was one of the most inspiring things that was happening in the world. And so I went to Poland. It took several years for me to get established. I had to learn the language, meet everybody in the underground, which was not easy to do because they were all illegal people. And then it was knocking on doors, trying to find someone who would be willing to take a chance on me because I didn't have any background as a foreign reporter. I wasn't representing a news organization. So it took a while, but finally, after a lot of determined knocking on doors, history took over and there was a second revolution in Poland, and all of a sudden, it was a hot spot in the world. And I was able to get on board with The Independent as a freelancer. They're a London-based newspaper and they were just starting out. And then on the basis of those clips, I was able to get some interest at the Washington office at NPR, and I started working for them. So we did that through the revolution. I also ran a couple of newspapers in Poland, and I established, with your taxpayers' money, the first independent school of journalism in the Eastern Bloc since World War II, and I ran it for 7 years. That's my path.
Mine is a lot less interesting. I've known I wanted to be a journalist since I was probably about 12, and I wrote for an online newspaper called The Cyber Beak at Jefferson Middle School in Eugene, Oregon. And so I worked at the high school paper. I was on we had our own TV news station that we ran at our middle school and then into high school. And so even though I always knew I never wanted to do broadcast reporting, I did every kind of reporting that I could in my community. And I actually, this may not mean a lot to many people, my first ever interview was with Corey Aquino, my second interview was with Ron Wyden, and my third interview was with Dick Cheney. And then I turned like 13 and completely peaked, so that was it. I went to USC and studied journalism at Annenberg, and while I was there, I started interning. And so interning is something that's been a passion of mine ever since, because the reason I chose USC in the first place, you come, you do the visit, and they just say location, location, location. If you want to do journalism on the West Coast, and I very much did, it was a great opportunity for me because I was interning with my, I was actually one of my classes, the professor would offer an internship to her top two students every year. So I took that internship, started work, working at the LA Times, was hired by the LA Times, and almost every position I've had since then has been because of that initial internship and the relationships I started there. From the paper, I went to magazines, and I was working at a magazine called Ciudad, which was a sister publication to Los Angeles Magazine and one of the first victims of the recession. But again, I was so fortunate in the internships I'd had that literally 2 hours after the magazine folded, the same professor from USC called and offered me a job with LA Magazine. And then from there, I went to the Center for Investigative Reporting when I started to focus on engaged journalism, which is still, was then and is still an emerging field of practice within journalism. And then now I am at Southern California Public Radio, or KPCC 89.3. And one of the funny things is I'm back working with one of my editors from the LA Times. We've now worked together at three different places. Newspapers, radio, and magazines. So journalism will take you a lot of places and through many platforms.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for coming out. When I was thinking back about like how I got here and in front of you all, it's kind of funny because like a shy kid without any clue of what he wanted to do found it hard to talk to people and thought, I'll go work at the school newspaper. That'll give me a reason to talk to people. And that's kind of how it happened. But some of the signs were there. Like when I was a kid, like the news was on during dinner, you know, and I hopefully this is okay for a teen podcast, but I can remember some kids on the bus talking about the word lesbian. And I thought it was somebody from Lebanon because the conflict in Beirut was happening at the time. And I had to correct them. I started a neighborhood newspaper. I ended up getting corrected, obviously. I started a neighborhood newspaper. Nobody would write the stories that I assigned. I wanted to name my sister before she was born, Morton Dean, who was a newscaster on television. So the signs were kind of always there. I was a curious kid. I was kind of a loner in a way, you know, and very shy. And so when the opportunity came my senior year to write sports stories and such for the hometown paper that I grew up in and then for the school newspaper and gave me a reason to talk to people, I just kind of found a sense of calm, right? Like I wasn't nervous talking to people or having conversations with people. I was getting them to talk about themselves and I felt like I was learning something there. And from there, it just kind of learned to craft a story. My career started in a weekly newspaper in a town of 1,200 people in the middle of Wisconsin. And again, to kind of be here in Los Angeles working at the LA Times is kind of silly because I never in my wildest dreams would have imagined that I would have progressed to a media market this size or a newspaper this size. And I really owe it just to kind of like working, right? Like I pick up a shovel and I go to work every day and I never turned down an opportunity to write a story, talk to somebody, do an odd job. My career has allowed me to deliver papers, to sell advertising, to run papers out to people who didn't have them. I've taken photos. I've laid out pages. I've written stories. I've done any job that is in front of me just to kind of learn a sense of what it takes in order to deliver stories and news to people. I came out here, it'll be what, 7 years ago, I think. Ashley and I started at KPCC right around the same time. And it really kind of opened up my eyes to like what's possible in my career. I've only had one internship and it was at this small paper in Manitowoc County, Wisconsin. But again, you know, being willing and open to the idea of doing anything that's put in front of you, and it really goes to any job, right? Or any career path, you know, being open to the doors that can open, the opportunities that are placed in front of you. You never know where you'd end up. just to put a final point on it, you know, I started off wanting to be a sports writer and now I work in a graphics department. Those two things kind of aren't further away from each other. I program computers. You take the paths that emerge and you explore them. And I guess it's kind of like up to you to bring the rest, right?
Thank you so much. So one more question before we open up to questions, but what's your day-to-day look like, or freelance versus in-house? And we can share the mic if you want.
Maybe they should start because they're doing it right now. Perfect. Mine can be kind of a footnote.
Anyone can start. We don't have to go in a row.
Well, I don't have that much of a traditional day-to-day. The way that I do community engagement, engaged journalism, really depends on the project and then the overall goals. And so there are days where we're out doing human-centered design interviews, researching the census or how we engage with parents of children 0 to 5. I do go through a lot of post-it notes, and I do spend a lot of time off-site facilitating conversations. I produce... with a colleague named John Cohn, we have a storytelling series called Unheard LA. And so sometimes we're coaching community members on how to tell their story in front of an audience of 700 people. Other times I'm copy editing a newsletter. So it's really hard to get to the day to day. I will say that I do work really long days, but I just love the work we're doing and all the different ways that it sort of manifests. And so that allows me to not ever get bored, but also to not ever be expected to be in every single meeting because they can't find me.
Meetings. I've had a lot of different day-to-days over the years. The day-to-day right now is one I feel like... There's a lot of skills, there's a lot of technological skills that you can bring to a career in journalism right now. But I think the biggest one is a non-technical skill, and that's just being able to talk to people and communicate and collaborate with folks. I think my days are just spent bouncing ideas off of, or having ideas bounced off of me, to try and figure out what the story is. So I work in the graphics department, and you know, a lot of it's charts, a lot of it's maps, but a lot of it's trying to figure out a visual way to tell a story. At our best, we're working alongside the reporters and the editors trying to figure out a way to condense, you know, a 50-inch, 1,500-word story into, you know, a simple diagram or a chart or something that is going to kind of help complement the story they're trying to tell. And so it's asking questions. It's trying to distill complex information down into a few sorts of key images. I think the most valuable one kind of came about over the past month or so. There was the plane crash in Ethiopia, and we're trying to figure out how we can kind of convey the design of an airplane and how the design of it contributed to needing a software system to overcome design flaws, right? And taking something that complex, right? There are, you know, thousands of pages written about this into, you know, a handful of images that will convey it, I think, is kind of the key. You know, and obviously to do that, there's technological skills, there's computer skills, there's design skills, artistic skills, but really just being able to work with people. I got a little bit away from the day-to-day. That's basically the day, though, like meeting with people, either large group, small group, and then trying to inspire the folks on the team to find, you know, the news of the day important and really kind of get across the need to maybe drop what they're doing that they've been working on for a while because something trumps everything else that's going on in the world. And I think I've learned a lot in terms of like the difference between doing it yourself, which I, you know, am apt to do, and trying to get others inspired to do it.
So I think probably foreign reporters today face some of the day-to-day challenges that I had back then, because a lot of foreign reporters foreign reporting is really expensive. And so a lot of news agencies will utilize freelancers because we're cheaper. And then that means that you really may be catering to a number of news organizations at one time, because that's how you make a living. That's how you put your budget together. But when you work for radio, when I was working for NPR and I was living in Poland, then you have the whole time differential, and you have a news agency or a news outlet that is always blasting the news. And so you have two major programs that you have to prepare for. One is for the morning in Washington, and one is for the evening. The day began for me at 6 a.m., you know, checking the news sources locally, the domestic news sources, because you have to be ready to tell people what the perspective is from the home country. And then usually for the morning story, you'd already have some tape, some sound bites that you could use. You'd put together a story, you'd edit it with a foreign desk, and then you'd go into the, we would say you would go into the studio, which meant back in those days, you don't have to do this anymore, but we had to take the phone apart. You had to have a special wartime tape recorder and microphone. You use that as your microphone, and with something called alligator clips, you would have your microphone going through the phone line. And you have to understand that many times in a poor country or in a country that is under conflict, you're dealing with a phone system that works not well at all. For example, there were no cell phones back then, right? There weren't any computers. Talk about getting lost and not being able to be found. You could truly do it back then and dig into a story. And then came the part of the day when you would go out, usually, and, you know, find people to interview about whatever the subject of the day was. And then you'd come back in the evening, and by 6 o'clock you'd be prepared with your editor to what the story would be for that evening. And by midnight, you would finish. So your day pretty much started 6 a.m., ended at midnight, unless the foreign desk decided to call you at 2 a.m. to remind you that you were the first story up the next morning, and they just wanted you to be sure. And now try to go back to sleep for the 2 hours that you have left of the night. Of course, all of that just goes out the window if there is a story that is moving fast. You know, if the military police are moving in, if there's a strike going on, if there are demonstrations somewhere, if there are roundtable negotiations with people meeting at odd times, if somebody from the underground has been killed. You know, there are a lot of things that affect it, and then you just hope that you can hang on by your fingernails and respond to all the demands that are coming from the foreign desk.
Wow, thank you. Opening it up to the audience, any questions so far?
How important would you say education is, like, in terms of like going to college? Like, do you need to major in English or journalism or writing or something like that in order to be successful? Or would you say it's more of a matter of just getting yourself out there and just, you know, showing up to a news company and be like, hey.
Thank you.
So I would, there are a lot of different things and conversations we have around this. It's often, you know, if you're planning to do undergrad and graduate school, only one of them would need to be, have a journalism focus or a writing focus. Even with that said, there are several people that I've worked with who've been really successful and didn't study journalism at all, but they went into, they had a focus in their undergraduate or graduate studies that was very, very specific, and so they were able to come into a newsroom and have an expertise. We've had actually two former colleagues who were lawyers, people who have science backgrounds. You know, it's one of those things where you don't have to go to school to be a really good journalist, but when we talk about earned internships, many of the internships are very competitive, and so just, it's almost like school can be a really great avenue to get the internship that's going to get you into the building and let you start to have those opportunities. I just hired, I think it's 11 interns. I just completed the hiring on Friday, but we had more than 300 candidates that came through. And I will say that one of the things that I'm proudest of is a couple of those interns we hired because we knew the other candidates would get hired, and these were the ones who needed it more because they maybe weren't from as competitive of school, or they weren't, that, you know, they didn't have a cousin who knew somebody. And so really thinking about how can we do that. But you know, there are so many different opportunities now when it comes to the kind of newsrooms you can contribute to. So there are several that it's just a different path toward getting there. But I would say, look at, we have, I keep saying we because I'm just imagining that Chris and I still work together. It's hopeful. But KPCC acquired LAIST.com last year, and we're constantly looking for community contributors. So if you go to LAIST.com, you can actually look at how do you start contributing and then work with an editor who's focused exclusively on that. And then there are several hyper local community organizations online, and that's another way to just start getting bylines.
Education is definitely important. Experience is important too, but that doesn't necessarily need to come from a professional news organization. Ashley mentioned some of like the local news organizations. Like I think of Boyle Heights, and is it Boyle Heights Beat? Right. And that's the kind of thing where like, if you're interested, like you can just pop in and be like, hey, you need anything written? You know, I'd say too, you know, like, so one of the interns that I, brought in and bringing in this summer to our team is a cartographer, right? Never worked in journalism before, but worked with a group looking at gerrymandering and how it could affect future elections. He makes maps. We make maps, right? That's going to be a boon for us, and it's going to be a benefit for him. Computer programming. And computer science students, I think, are very valuable. Anybody who's versed in like data science, right? Mathematics, statistics, economics, there's a background there and there's a need there. And I think it's, you can learn to write in the style of journalism. You can learn to cover the bases and ask the questions that need to. And if you have a background in astronomy or economics or statistics or biology, like there's subject areas out there that we need to cover, that we need to communicate stories to the public about, right? And so you're going to have kind of a ready-made knowledge base in there that will allow you to be successful. I think a lot of folks go to graduate school now to get their master's in journalism. And I can kind of understand that because things are kind of tight and the job market is kind of tight out there. And I think the last thing I would say is be open to smaller publications. I feel like a lot of folks are drawn to the coast with good reason, right? And as somebody who, you know, got here later in life, you can pick up a lot along the way. You know, the little towns and the smaller towns and the bigger towns and the bigger papers. You can pick up a lot of things along the way. I think it's probably rare. I don't know if the folks I work with that are younger that know how rare it is for somebody to go right from grad school to the LA Times. But that's also me being an older person at this point in life, adjusting to new realities.
So most of the interns that I hire are college students or within 1 year of having graduated. Every once in a while I'll do a high school program. I didn't mention before, I would also add Pasadena City College has like a certification program when it comes to broadcast, and that's another way that we actually get more community college students into our programs. But yeah, it's primarily college, and that really has to do with the liability of having somebody in the building under 18 who's not supervised. I wanted to, with what Chris said, it is really hard to find journalists who are okay with being anywhere between the coasts. And so there are a lot of opportunities, and there's a real need for more journalists because we're experiencing information vacuums throughout the country, and that includes in Southern California. But it's just a very critical time to be a journalist and to be willing to go outside of a geography like LA.
Let me get that question first, and then what's your question?
So my question was, do you feel like being a journalist kind of harms, or do you think it like helps your social figure?
When you say social figure, do you mean life? I'm really, really fortunate in the kind of journalism that I practice, and I have a hyper awareness to the traditions of doing acts of journalism to people, and there are communities, there are regions, there are neighborhoods, I mean, that have really been traumatized because of acts of journalism in the past. When it comes to the kind of work that I'm really blessed to do, we spend a lot of time trying to address communities that have traditionally been underserved or misserved by media to bring people into the journalism process to make sure that as much as we talk about news literacy, we're also talking about community literacy. How do we better serve a community by better understanding them? And that can mean, you know, bringing people the skills so that they're equipped to tell their own stories. It can be just being more present and saying that when you share something with me, it's not going to be transactional, it's going to be relational. I'm going to reflect back to you what you've shared. And also saying that when we're amplifying and elevating these stories, when we ask people to tell their story or to share an experience, we're asking them to reflect on what they individually have experienced. We're not asking one person to speak for an entire people. And because of that, I get hugged a lot, and it's most of the time a really wonderful thing. And so I know that that's not the universal experience as a journalist. And I can also say, having been a journalist who's worked in Mexico, that I've also seen, you know, the very dangerous flip side of that. But then also just having, when you work for NPR, when you work for public media, there's a lot of love from, it's a smaller audience, but it's a very passionate audience.
I guess that, you know, my experience, I just want to add something about the education, because if you're going to be a foreign journalist, I think that it's absolutely required that you know the language of the country from which you are going to be reporting. It's the only dignified way of interacting with people, which goes back to this relationship to the people that you're reporting on. I mean, I spent years tracking down people in the underground, learning their language, being able to know their everyday lives. And that was so important when the story started to become really heightened, because there was trust. Underground movements are built on loyalty. And if you go from one person to another and say, well, Rishik sent me, okay, well, you're in. If you don't have that calling card, then you're probably going to have a little bit of a harder time. And I think that what Ashley said about, you know, the respect of the story, the respect of the people, the respect of the human tragedy sometimes that you're seeing, it's really important to be humble before your story, to not feel that here I am, the American journalist, I'm going to tell the world what's happening here. No, I'm here to listen. I'm here to try to get it right, and to put your voice out there the way you want it to be heard.
Thank you.
In a general term, what do you think, let's say, for example, what do you look for in an intern? What kind of skills you would want to have for an intern? Did I say that correctly? And let's say for a reporter, the same question as well. What kind of skills or traits would you look for if you were to look for an intern as well?
So for, in terms of foreign reporting, definitely the language. You have to have a good background in the subject that you're covering. Many newsrooms, even NPR at the foreign desk, doesn't have specialties in all the different countries. They certainly didn't know anything about Eastern Europe when I was there, when I was in Poland and reporting from there. So it was really significant that I was well educated about the country and the political situation and the history. That's what I would look for from a person who might come to work for me as a foreign reporter, and a sense of good judgment, because there are a lot of situations that you will get into if you are in a country where there is conflict that could put you or the people you are covering in danger. I mean, for you, it might just mean deportation, but for them, it could mean prison or something worse. And so you really have to know how to judge what's going on around you, to evaluate a situation and decide when it's time to just let it go.
So I'm really passionate on the subject of intern hiring, and And part of it is because, you know, this year I read 300 something applications. I've read more than 1,000. And this is sort of controversial when it comes to hiring practices anyway, but I care a lot about cover letters. I want in the cover letter to know that you've done your research so you know who we are. Again, our organization does have a few names, but when I get applications that start with Dear iHeartMedia, I'm like, no, that is not this, that's not us. And I want you to spend the first few sentences of your cover letter asserting your passion, not your privilege. So we will have a number of people who send in their thing, and they're basically telling me how wonderful their life is, which is great, good for them. But I want to know why they care about this thing that they want to do. And I will also say that I sort of go about the intern hiring process differently. I don't hire for specific positions. I don't have a checklist I have to work my way through. I instead look for the candidates that most excite me and figure out what is the intersection between their skill set and their passion. And then also, do we have the capacity to have interns in those areas of our organization? And so this summer we have hired interns who will be focused on data, who will be focused on Census 2020, interns who will be supporting engaged journalism, interns who will be running the boards. So they're helping to actually get the audio on air for our shows, reporting interns, and an intern with our live events team, and then another one with one of our news magazine shows. And so, you know, it really is going, I don't have this list I have to work through. Instead, I'm going to see how can this be an opportunity for us to practice what we preach and to invest in developing a diverse and local pipeline of talent.
Real quick, I think you'll find as more of folks our age get in, you know, late 30s, mid 40s, get into the area where we're able to evaluate, we're taking the opportunity to really kind of practice what we've always thought should be a good practice. And you'll see a lot of applications with some really kind of like explicit instructions about what folks are looking for, right? And those are there for a reason. It's to target a certain area or to target a certain type of person who can kind of convey their story and convey what it is they want to bring to a role. And I think I feel, to use the word privilege, about being in a position to kind of look for that and to kind of practice what I've always thought was a good thing. I will say it's a lot more difficult than I ever imagined. But to kind of echo Ashley, cover letters matter, and the story that you kind of convey and the passion that you convey matter to the person reading it. And if you don't kind of hit some of that right away, it I don't know what it is I'm trying to say. It doesn't end up in the junk, but it also, you know, others rise above it. You know what I mean?
Thank you. I just have a follow-up to all of that. Is there any type of technology people should be well versed in when they want to work as a journalist?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on your role, right? But like knowing your way around a computer, I think just because the internet is the internet and there's so much information out there, knowing where to find information, credible information, accurate information, information from government resources, whether that's federal, state, or local, I think is important. And knowing what the... knowing the questions you ask of that information, I think, are important. So, you know, basic computer research skills.
You know, we have, as an organization that's primarily known as a radio station, we end up having journalists that come from all different kinds of background. And we've really become we really don't care about what kind of ability you have to produce the sound or that. We care about just that you have the core journalism skills and a mindset to go after the information and to not come in with bias.
I think that you probably have to be ready for none of that technology to be available to you if you're going to do foreign reporting and you're going to end up in a country where there is active strife. So think about what would have happened back in 1980 and how you would have gotten the story out then, because that is a situation you can end up in.
Thank you. Any questions from the audience? Okay, none so far. All right, thank you for the other questions. Let's see. I will come back to mine. How do you keep your relationships strong? Because I can tell it's a collaborative
career. How do you keep your relationships strong? And also, can you talk a little about introverts versus extroverts and if this is a job for either?
I'm an introvert, but I professionally work as an extrovert, which is one of those things where do people know what introvert and extrovert are? So essentially, an extrovert is somebody who gets energy by being social, being around people that, you know, that gives you all the feels. An introvert is somebody who feels that as draining. And so for me, I recharge by being alone. I recharge by having quiet time. But then I work in an aspect of journalism that is all about relationships. And so I just try to figure out how I can balance that. And I will say that I do get energy from knowing how this kind of work can affect others and that, and it's just really fulfilling for me. When it comes to managing relationships, it's something that I should say, I also run a nonprofit called Journalism That Matters that is focused on catalyzing conversation and connection. And so what I've learned through that process is all of these things that I try to do outside of our organization when it comes to community relationships, I've learned to do inside of the organization too. And so it can be the way that we facilitate conversations. It can be how we run meetings. I essentially have a Play-Doh lending library in my office. People come and get it, and they're just thinking and brainstorming and collaborating differently. And so it's all of those things. And then again, just knowing that we're not an advocacy organization, but we are an activation organization. And how can we create news that is going to get people excited, get people invited into the conversation, and be, thinking about what Chris does, whether we're talking about engagement work or we're talking about graphics and visualization, that we're talking about how do we invite more people into this information and let them do something with it. So I think it's just built into everything that I try to practice.
I'd add real quick, just keeping in mind that we're all kind of rowing in the same direction, right? We're all on the same team, and that the stresses that pop up, because they do, in the course of a day or a month or a year in terms of the news that's you're covering and the stories that you're trying to convey and tell, that we're all doing the best that we can, because it can get stressful. I think of the time in November when there was an election followed by a shooting followed by massive wildfires, and our shop, our paper was operating at a stress level that hadn't been reached in quite some time. And it's easy to lose sight of the fact that we're all kind of helping each other get through it, And that, goes double for what you've experienced overseas.
Can I add one thing? Sorry. Just real quick on that. I'm not going to go tell you to hug your local journalist, but I will say that to what Chris just said, journalists are often at the front line of really traumatic events. And so that's another thing that that more and more in recent years we've had conversations around self-care or when do you know when you're experiencing post-traumatic stress? Because whether you're in, you're watching people who've just lost their homes or they've lost a relative or you're covering a manhunt or I have friends who are in Texas where, they had a good year where just every couple months there was a massive tragedy and you would talk with journalists and they were shaking. They were just so affected by it. And so I think that it's also sort of just checking in with yourself when that's what you've signed up to do, that you just know sort of what to expect or how to cope.
I think that there's a lot of emphasis in journalism on competition. Mm-hmm. And when you're part of a foreign press corps, that can be part of it. We were very fortunate in Poland that there was such a small foreign press corps that we needed each other in order to tell the story. I had better language skills than many people, so there were times when, somebody was holding the microphone in front of the general's mouth, but nobody really knew what he was saying, and they didn't have a translator with them, and they had to go back to their office and file. So I would sit down with them, and we would play the tape, and we would get the facts out, get the quotes out that they needed. So we really worked together. The other thing is that, and I don't want to emphasize like the danger too much, but the fact is that, you know, if you're working in an area where something really is deemed illegal and there is a military force or a Secret Service there to try to ensure that what is illegal stays out, you have to be careful that someone knows where you are, and you have to have somebody that you can count on to, you know, help you out if you get stuck. And so building those relationships with your colleagues is really important. And sometimes it might even be building the relationship with the people you're covering, because they may be the only ones who will really be able to help you in a time of need.
Thank you. Any questions popping up with the audience?
Yeah.
Okay. So my next, actually, I'd like to circle back. Do you have any like preferred self-care, and how do you self-care when you're in a foreign land all by yourself, perhaps?
That's hard. Especially when, you know, when you're operating in this, at this stress level all the time. The revolution in Poland, the last one, took a year. It happened, you all know about the Berlin Wall, where there was a year of active political activity in Poland that preceded the fall of the Berlin Wall, and actually the government there changed before Germany's did. And during that time, you were out there all the time, rain, snow, whatever. And I think that one thing that was hardest for me was that the foreign desk back in Washington didn't seem to have a clue. I mean, I had one editor who really got it and understood when, you know, I was tired and would at least recognize it, that was going on. Everybody else just seemed to think that, you know, it's so hard here in Washington running the office, why can't you get that story in quicker? So I don't think I was very successful in finding ways to deal with that stress, except, you know, now and then there was a break, and you'd either get together with your colleagues from the press corps so you could debrief. Sometimes that's how the day ended. You know, it would be after midnight and you'd finally all sit around a table and have dinner, and get called away one by one because they wanted you to correct the story. But at least we knew what each other was going through. And then if there were also people that were your friends in the country, they would certainly understand what you were going through.
I think if you ask the leadership of my organization, it's often we order pizzas. When there's a manhunt or an election, we just order really large pizzas. But also I think, you know, like organizations are getting better at recognizing this, both as the newsrooms, but also the organizations that are out there to support. So there's DART, which is a resource. There's also out of the University of Oregon, a program that's looking at what journalists are experiencing with this. So there's emerging research that I think will continue to guide us as we go forward. But just as far as the day-to-day goes, I mean, I think it's taking advantage, like make the HR office when you are a practicing journalist, and provided that you're somewhere near an HR office, a place that you visit so you know what resources your organization offers, whether it's at KPCC, you know, they have psychologists basically on the line that you can call if you need. And I know it's an underutilized option that we have. Finding people in the newsroom that you can go to and that you can share with. You know, a conversation that I had in journalism, we still, so KPCC is majority women, and about 42% of our content is people of color. We still, you know, we actually, our listenership, the listenership for KPCC is pretty close to the demographics of the region that we serve. Our staffing isn't quite there yet. But the reason I bring it up is that we've also had conversations about, you know, just what it means to have people of color in roles, in leadership roles, because then it changes the dynamics of when we have safe and welcoming spaces for people to have conversations, depending on what they're dealing with. You know, when you think about we think about shootings or relationship with community policing, and just knowing that, you know, that when we report on the news, we're also experiencing and processing the news, and that's different depending on where you grew up, how you grew up, and often just sort of how you present in the world.
Thank you. Any, would you like to add anything?
I'm not a good practicer of self-care. I'm getting better. But I kind of am a workaholic and an overperformer. And I think it's important to have those relationships where people can recognize when you're kind of hitting the red line, and to help you realize you need to dial back. And those are either personal or professional, right? It's funny to be sitting up here because I'm at a point now where I finally became an advocate for myself, knowing that I needed to take some time and kind of dial some things back. And it's freeing, you know. I can only imagine, though, how many others maybe don't know if they have that, you know, in these newsrooms as we're going through just incredible times of maybe even self-imposed in some respects, right? So like everything is breaking news anymore, but there is a lot of like important news. I just look at yesterday's headlines and the ridiculousness is the only word that comes to mind, but it's tragic, right? Because I'm outside of it, we're outside of it, and there are people whose lives are affected by it every moment, right? And when you get down into it, it's hard not to kind of accumulate that secondhand and know that it's not the same stresses that they're dealing with, but feeling a need to tell their stories and that you just can't possibly do enough. It's really hard not to let it spiral sometimes. And so recognizing yourself and knowing yourself, I think, is a key to self-care. As the forms that takes, I mean, that's up to the person, right? Like I like to go bash around on the basketball court. Others will meditate. Others have unhealthy habits, right? So it's really, you know, finding a way to manage that and have the relationships.
I mean, there are very few journalists that got into it for the money. And so I think like this is work that we do because we're passionate about it and because we believe in the mission and the possibility of it. And that makes reeling it in hard sometimes.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, depending on the story, what I go back to is the strikes at the Gdańsk shipyard, where you would walk into this place where people had walked off their job. The factory was surrounded by military police, and you walked into that factory, and you felt something. They were there for each other 100%, and they had made this decision that they were going to break this down. And so you forget about all that. You forget about self-care. You forget about going to the gym, even if there is one. You know, that's the privilege of journalism, that you become a part of these things that change the world, and it gives such meaning to your life that in the end you decide it's, you know, if you get stressed out for a while, well, it certainly was worth it because your life is that much richer because you participated in their achievements and struggles. I think that what I always looked for when I did foreign reporting was to know more than anybody, to have more depth, because my relationships with the people were years long, and it wasn't like they were, like I was just walking into their lives and telling them to tell me their story. So I really looked for the human part of it that maybe wasn't as fabulous as what you'd see in the Washington Post, but which gave you a sense of what those people were feeling in their hearts.
There are some things that are just kind of like the basic, right? So like, what's a good way to put it? It's like the lowest common denominator sort of like facts that come out there, right? So like news breaks, something happens, you're going to kind of have this nugget of a story, right? And a lot of it's going to kind of be the same. And from there, you know, if it's a story that has legs, that is kind of day after day, that comes down to like the relationships you have and how deep you can kind of go, the framing or the angle that you have of it, right? So, you know, we look at this poster on the wall there, right? And somebody's going to talk about the book she's standing on. Somebody's going to talk about the spaceships flying around in the background. Somebody's going to talk about the color of the lightsaber, right? Finding different facets or angles to take of a story. And then from there too, it's like who your audience is, right? So our audiences are similar but very different, right? I think, you know, KPCC is very much Southern California, so they're going to ignore something like, you know, the Ethiopian plane crash. Not ignore, but they're not going to cover it as much, right? Whereas the LA Times is going to cover a little bit more of it, and they're going to cover it from a business angle or a transportation angle, and maybe not necessarily from a policy angle. I think the last thing is just also understanding what it is that a particular audience needs to know about something, right? The New York Times audience is going to need to know something maybe different than our audience is going to need to know. So there's kind of a calculus that takes place, you know, and you kind of do it without really recognizing it after a while, right? As you kind of build up those muscles.
I didn't have an answer for this initially, but I think that one thing I would say is that KPCC, we're looking for what the invitation is in the story. And so one thing we started doing a couple years ago with the wildfires is that as they're burning, we're inviting people's questions. And so we're not only going to incorporate those questions into the public facing reporting, we're also going to answer them privately. And so I actually have a very clear memory of flying in December 4 last into Burbank Airport, seeing the fires burning everywhere. And at the same time, I'm typing answers into emails to individuals, because when we launched this option for people to ask whatever questions they had about the burning, you know, the areas burning, we expected questions, which we did get about, you know, well, we're right by the ocean. Why aren't they using salt water? Or who gets to name the fires? Which way is the fire going? But we also started to get a lot of questions saying, here's my address. Is it still there? Or, you know, what do you know about Malibu Paradise Camp? What's going on there? And oftentimes these were questions that we could answer without any additional reporting. But people are so scared, or they're having such a hard time processing all of the information that you're talking about, that we were able to take a step back, find the answers within our own reporting, and then just give them back directly to community members. And so, yes, we have a weekly QM of 800 or 900,000 people, but we got to super serve 300 people, and that will forever change the relationship that we have with those 300 folks.
They will remember that forever. So we're almost out of time. We have about 5 more minutes. My last question is, how do you see the field changing in the next 5 years?
I haven't a clue.
It's changing a lot. And I think even just when you say the field, you know, we have such different approaches to journalism, whether we're talking about primarily, you know, whether we're talking about platforms or who gets to tell a story, who owns that, the relationships we have with community versus the relationships we have with audience versus the idea of one monolithic audience versus several audiences. We're both part of newsrooms that participate in a program that's called Table Stakes, that's really focused on saying, you know, what you think of an audience is actually several audiences. And when you think of the term audience, we're really not, it's not about saying people who like this thing or that, but it's saying, what is their shared information habit or need, and how can we better understand that? And so something I'm really excited about is we've done a lot of research about how can we best serve parents of children 0 to 5 in LA County. And before we started to try to answer that question, we went out and we did a lot of research. And one of the questions we would ask is, you know, and you two will like this answer, I think, of like, you know, where do you go? Like when you're trying to figure something out for your child, where do you go for information? So we weren't using words that were going to trigger certain responses, because if I say like, who do you follow on Facebook, or where do you go on Facebook for news, you're going to tell me somebody who's on Facebook, even if that's not what you do. So if we, you know, take a step back and say like, where do you go for that information? Person after person said, I go to the library. I look for the flyers that are there. Several people said, I go to Instagram and I see what other moms are doing. Or there's an 18-year-old mom who said, I call my grandma in Mexico. No matter what's going on, her resource is calling her grandma in Mexico. And so I'm really fortunate in that I have leadership who has said, okay, well, let's lean into that. And so we've started delivering news by postcard. We're launching a text messaging service where we're doing this super tailored information, because we're able to go very, very deep in serving particular audiences as opposed to just going after that breadth.
I like the idea of like the micro audience and recognizing like who needs what, especially in a town this size, right? Can it be an aspirational future? News brands are reasserted as fact-finding organizations and cut through the noise of everything else that's flying around in the world. I don't know what the future of an individual publication is. I think the future of news, at least in the United States, is the recognition that all of these organizations together are stronger than the kind of the fractured media environment that we have. Media being everything from social media to alternative media to movies, music, television, and recognizing that competing on stories isn't as important as making sure that those stories resonate and continue to resonate until there's, I don't want to say resolution, because things aren't usually resolved, but is acceptance the word I'm looking for? That either things can change or they can't. I just think of the political climate and the situation along the southern border being kind of first and foremost as something that it can't be overshadowed by the next thing. And it takes all the news organizations to realize that they can't pivot away from shining a spotlight on a situation like that for the next thing, that it has to be reported and it has to be kind of at the forefront of what they do every day. And that's just one example of however many issues that are kind of going on right now. It's almost like you hear like NFL owners or like Major League Baseball owners colluding to keep salaries down. It's almost like, and I'm going to put this out there, but like media organizations colluding to say, we're going to keep hammering at these stories and keep highlighting these incidences. In order for it to, for those stories to be heard. And if that's, you know, biased in some respects, I guess I hope it's biased in favor of storytelling, right? And biased in favor of the truth as opposed to one particular facet of that.
Yeah, I didn't have an answer, but now after listening to you folks, maybe there is something from my experience that can be aspirational. I think that's a great way of looking at it. One thing that I mourn really as a news consumer right now is, is the room in the profession for that journalist to get lost, and rather for the journalist to be used to fill the gaps that are in the program model, so that there is sometimes not a great enough opportunity for a journalist to just stay with the story. They'll be called away from the story because, oh, we need this, you know. At the New York, how many times did I hear from National Public Radio's foreign desk, well, the New York Times is reporting. Well, sometimes the New York Times was wrong because they just didn't know enough. And that journalist who is going to challenge that needs to have the opportunity and the time to go and do the research that it takes to show a side of the story that somebody else isn't getting. That's one thing that I would like to see come back. You know, we don't have a gatekeeper anymore. Okay, that's great that there are all these different ways of getting information in, but we do need to have some way of organizing the way the news is reported that gives us the leeway to go in depth. And the other thing is that, you know, you mentioned libraries. We did a program at my library. I'm at the Memorial Branch Library in Wilshire right now, and we did a program some time ago about it was called Migrant Stories After the Caravan. I had some photographers from my neighborhood came to me and said they had been traveling to Tijuana and they wanted to know if they could show their pictures at our branch. We had standing room only at that program. And it was, for me, like a meeting of the underground in Poland. Everybody was so focused. It was hot in that room. And people really cared. And they were really seeing something that they weren't seeing anywhere else. Or at least maybe not in the caring and human way that these photographers told the stories of the people that they were seeing and photographing and talking to. And I left journalism and I went into a field that allowed me at a saner pace to deal with information needs. And when programs like that happen, I just feel really happy that somehow it's come together and the library is doing that informational role in as good a way as any journalism outlet that I know of today.
Thank you so much. Sorry, I got caught up in it. Thank you. That was wonderful. And thank you all so much for being here today. Let's give our panelists. So thank you to the audience and thank you to the panelists.